Okay, today we're continuing with our series of 27 pioneers, and we'll be looking now at number 25, A.T. Jones, lived from 1850 to 1923. The issues of Lest We Forget that address his life history is volume 7, number 4, 1888, the Minneapolis General Conference, as well as volume 8, number 1, which has an extract of his articles, his writings on the topic of the faith of Jesus. A.T. Jones was born 1850, April, in the state of Ohio. At the age of 20, he was enlisted in the U.S. Army, and he was stationed at Fort Walla Walla in the Washington Territory at the time. It was before that there was a Washington state. There in the U.S. Army, he was fighting some of the Indian wars that took place at the time. And about 4 years after he began in the Army, while he was at Walla Walla, August of 1874, after having heard an evangelist by the name of I.D. Van Horn, he decided to accept the third angel's message. And he was baptized on August the 8th, 1874, at the age of 24. He had already been studying history. Apparently, during his free time as a soldier, he was not whiling it away with the usual leisure activities of soldiers, but had been reading history books. And when he saw Van Horn's prophetic chart, he realized that what he had been reading in his history books matched the prophecies exactly, and he was amazed. He had no idea that the prophecies related to actual history before. So the story that's recorded in the Review and Herald of this young soldier coming out of the water was that he came out of the water with his arms upraised and said, "Dead to the world and alive to thee, O my God." So he began then a life devoted to God. Obviously still much a student of history and interested in connecting that with prophecy. A little over a year later, in November of 1875, when he's 25 years old, he was discharged from the Army, had a rank of sergeant at the time, and he actually began working with the evangelists as a tent master, going around with Elder Van Horn.
With the same one?
Helping him raise up churches and in the Northwest. A couple years later, when he's 27, April of 1877, he actually marries Van Horn's sister-in-law, Frances E. Patton. And so the Van Horns and the Joneses become interrelated in their families. And you'll notice that if you look at his obituary information, that the survivors of Jones included Van Horns. Later that same year, October of 1877, again, he's 27 years old, the North Pacific Conference was formed of these churches that they had raised up there in the Northwest, and Jones was elected treasurer. I believe that there were about three church leaders at the time, and he being one of them, he was elected the treasurer. The next year, at the age of 28, he was ordained in Oregon, along with the other two men, I.D. Van Horn and W.L. Raymond. He obviously continued his church work there in the upper North Pacific. And a couple of years later, in 1880, at the age of 30, he became secretary of the new Upper Columbia Conference. 3 years later, his first child was born, a daughter, Lynetta. However, she was retarded, and her care caused some difficulties and tensions in the family, according to the records that we have. 2 years later, 1885 now, he's 35 years old, just some 11 years after his baptism. He's invited by J.H. Wagner to come work at the Pacific Press, working with the Signs of the Times as one of the assistants there. At the same time, when he moved down to the Bay Area, the Signs was being published by Pacific Press in Oakland, California. He began to teach Bible at the Healdsburg College, which was at a town north of San Francisco, up at Healdsburg. So now he's moved from evangelism and church administration into publishing and education, two of the other ministries of the church that forms the method by which the Advent movement is carrying the messages to the world and the landmark truths, preparing a people for Christ's coming. The next year, at the age of 36, 1886, he becomes co-editor of the Signs of the Times with E.J. Wagner, J.H. Wagner's son. When J.H. Wagner moved to Europe and became one of our workers in Europe there. The May the 13th issue of 1886, volume 12, number 18, shows his name first on the masthead there along with E.J. Wagner. In that position of being co-editor of the Signs, Jones began to publish some views of prophecy with his knowledge of history that varied with the standard Seventh-day Adventist positions on these prophetic views, which had been written in years past by Uriah Smith, whose works on prophecy had become the standard works of the church. The next year, February 18, 1887, Ellen White writes him a letter along with E.J. Wagner when he's 37 years old. And this document is actually the first document in the Ellen G. White 1888 materials. In that letter, she gives these two young men quite a bit of counsel, particularly regarding the danger of publishing differences, making differences and views on Scripture public to those looking on. And she counseled very strongly against doing that. And these two young men did accept her advice. They became very much more cautious in how they were dealing with publishing variant views. However, the background for these differences and these conflicts actually showed the beginning of the conflict that would lead on over the next months and years into what has become known as the 1888 conflict. The same year, 1887, he's still age 37, he becomes active in opposing Sunday laws. He becomes editor of the American Sentinel with E.J. Wagner, and his name first shows in the June issue of 1887, volume 2, number 6. That American Sentinel was begun by J.H. Wagner to specifically promote religious liberty and oppose the union of the trend toward the union of church and state that was taking place in the United States. Promotion of Sunday laws and the desire to make America a Christian nation officially. At the same time, Jones was also pastor of the Healdsburg SDA Church. And that year, 1887, his second daughter, Desi, was born. The next year, he's 38 years of age, and the 1888 conference at Minneapolis occurs. And after that conference, there's more meetings at Battle Creek. We've already mentioned the 1888 conference and some of the other pioneer overviews that we've done, but particularly Jones and along with him, E.J. Wagner, become very key individuals in the events of that general conference session and the ministerial institute that's associated with it. Ellen White, in commenting on these meetings, has a lot of things to say about Jones specifically. Before we read those, let's look at the statement of the general conference bulletin that was published there with the 1888 general conference session. October the 26th, 1888, General Conference Bulletin, Daily Bulletin, page 24.7, reports that Elder A.T. Jones has given his closing lecture on church and state, the principles which underlie such union and their development in the Roman Empire, resulting in the setting up of the papacy. So he was already describing these sequence of events in world history that showed what happens when church and state is united and the Romanism that results from it. Also in the bulletin published October the 31st, there were various resolutions listed, and one of the resolutions mentions Jones by name. This is the resolution, page 31, paragraph 34. That A.T. Jones, if the way opens to do so, visit Boston, Chicago, and other points where local conferences secure suitable places to reach the masses of the people and present the subject of religious liberty. So he was seen as an effective presenter, defender of religious liberty, and the resolution basically called for him to be freed up to do that and do it in several places, as prominent cities around the United States. Another statement, resolution, page 37, paragraph 17, reads this way, that this conference appoint a delegation of three, of which Elder A.T. Jones shall be one, to appear before the Senate Committee on Education and Labor at the next session of Congress, and in the interests of religious liberty, to use every reasonable effort to secure the defeat of the Blair Bill. That was published November the 2nd. The Blair Bill specifically was one of the attempts to pass a national Sunday law. And he was appearing before that committee of the Senate to oppose the passage of that bill. The history shows that the bill did not succeed, and it seems clear that Jones's contribution for opposing it was instrumental in bringing that bill to a defeat as well. Out of the General Conference of 1888, many other things flow. We've touched on those in some of the other overviews, as I mentioned, but here are some of the comments that Ellen White has made about the meeting and about Jones in particular in relation to the meetings. In one of her letters to her family, she said, "We have had the hardest and most incomprehensible tug of war we have ever had among our people." 1888 materials, page 182.2. So clearly there were tensions, there were conflicts, there were differences there at the Minneapolis conference that Ellen White described as the hardest and most incomprehensible that she had observed yet among the Seventh-day Adventists. When they returned to Battle Creek following the Minneapolis meetings, Ellen White's burden was that Jones have a chance to share in Battle Creek what he had been sharing in Minneapolis as well. And there was difficulty getting that done. Ellen White actually, if we recall her history, she had been living in Healdsburg, California, up to the time of Minneapolis. She came to Minneapolis, and she never returned to her home in Healdsburg. She actually went to Battle Creek. She stayed there. That was her base for the next better part of the next 3 years, after which she was sent to Australia, as we noted in her historical overview. And from this position in Battle Creek, she attempted to get the message of Minneapolis and its implications, its application to the church's ministries and to the church's pastors and workers and teachers, bring the application of that message so that God's will could be done in preparing his people for the final work and then carrying the message to the world. But the difficulty she had was stated this way, 1888 materials, page 189.3. "We have had to work and pray and work even to have Brother Jones obtain a hearing in Battle Creek. And many of our leading men were provoked after they heard him talk to think that there were those in responsible positions who would close the door to light and to knowledge, keeping out just what they need. So there were those of the leading men that were favorable, and they couldn't understand why others in responsible positions were blocking the way. Ellen White states further regarding the work that she saw Jones and also E.J. Wagner doing on page 228.1, that God, she says, he has given these men, speaking of A.T. Jones and E.J. Wagner, a work to do and a message to bear, which is present truth for this time. They knew that wherever this message comes, its fruits are good. A vigor and a vital energy are brought into the church, and where the message is accepted, their hope and courage and faith beam in the countenance of all those who open their eyes to see, and their understanding to perceive, and their hearts to receive the great treasure of truth. Again, 228.1, 1888 materials. The next year, 1889, Jones is now 39 years of age, and he travels with Ellen White to various camp meetings, giving presentations, and there are significant meetings that occur at South Lancaster, Massachusetts, and also in Chicago. These are documented from Ellen White's viewpoint in the Ellen White 1880 materials. There were also meetings in Battle Creek with ministerial institutes, 1889, and also in 1890, and he was helping, Jones was helping with that as well. Regarding the South Lancaster meetings, this is Ellen White's comment. Elder Jones came from Boston and labored most earnestly for the people, speaking twice and sometimes three times a day. Let me interject here. She says he came from Boston because just prior to the meetings at South Lancaster for the Adventist, he had been in Boston giving public lectures on religious liberty and separation of church and state. So when he comes to South Lancaster, she says he labored most earnestly for the people, and he spoke twice or more times a day. She says, the flock of God were fed with soul-nourishing food. The very message the Lord has sent to the people of this time was presented in the discourses. Meetings were in progress from early morning till night, and the results were highly satisfactory. 1880 materials, page 267.7. Regarding the meetings in Chicago, this is her description of those. Elder A.T. Jones has labored faithfully to instruct those assembled, and in breaking to their souls the bread of life. We have felt sorry that not only every Seventh-day Adventist church, but every church, whatever their faith and doctrines, could not have the precious light of truth as it has been so clearly presented. I know it would have been a rich feast to very many souls, not of our faith, to see the plan of salvation so clearly and simply defined. That's the 1888 materials, page 280, paragraph 2. The description, I think, is very significant. He is breaking the bread of life to the souls that were there. It was precious light of truth, clearly presented. She says it was a rich feast, and the plan of salvation was clearly and simply defined. And then, in light of these meetings as well, she makes this observation regarding Jones. I think that Elder A.T. Jones should attend our large camp meetings and give to our people and to outsiders as well the precious subject of faith and the righteousness of Christ. There is a flood of light in this subject, and if he goes to the canvassers' meetings only, how can the light come before the largest number? So not only was she recommending that he go to the canvassers, the booksellers, and give them the message that they can carry to homes, but also he should come to the camp meetings where our own people should hear the message of, how did she describe it? The precious subject of faith and the righteousness of Christ. And on that subject, she said there was a flood of light. God was pouring out tremendous amounts of light on the subject of righteousness by faith. That was 291.1 from the 1888 materials. In 1891, Jones is now 41 years old. He publishes the first of his major works, The Two Republics, or Rome and the United States of America, showing the parallel between the Republic of Rome and the Republic of the United States, and significant parallels they are in history, those two powers clearly being part of the fourth kingdom of Daniel, and the global system identified as Babylon in the book of Revelation. This publication of this book would be one of five major books that he would do on overviews of history from a prophetic viewpoint and in the light of the great controversy in the message of righteousness by faith in religious liberty. We'll note the other ones here as he publishes them later. This is the first one in 1891. Over the years 1892 to 95, Ellen White has many statements endorsing the message God has given him. There's one that I want to read. I've given some extracts in the handout here. But there's one I want to read, the first one I want to read in greater detail. Let me just read here the paragraphs relating to this statement. She's describing very clearly that these men, both Jones and Wagner, had a message from God, and giving a very significant caution to those who were listening, questioning, wondering whether God was working. And here's how she put it. It is quite possible that elders Jones or Wagner may be overthrown by the temptations of the enemy, but if they should, this would not prove that they had had no message from God, or that the work that they had done was all a mistake. But should this happen, should they be overthrown by temptations, should this happen, how many would take this position, the position that they had had no message from God? And she says, how many would take this position and enter into a fatal delusion because they are not under the control of the Spirit of God? They walk in the sparks of their own kindling and cannot distinguish between the fire they have kindled and the light which God has given. And they walk in blindness, as did the Jews. She further states, I know that this is the very position many would take if either of these men were to fall. And I pray that these men, upon whom God has laid the burden of a solemn work, may be able to give the trumpet a certain sound and honor God at every step, and that their path at every step may go brighter and brighter until the close of time. Those two paragraphs are the 1888 materials, page 1044.3 and 1045.1. Her desire, unfortunately, of their path growing brighter and brighter was not to be realized as she hoped, as we will see in the history. But also her fear. And what she said actually that she knew also took place, that there were many who came to try to discredit the entire message because of the stumbling of these two men. Other statements that she made about the message that these men were giving, page 1052.2, the message of God to the Laodicean church. She describes that as being what they were giving. The significance of that is that it is the message to Laodicea, the testimony of the true witness, that prepares God's people for the outpouring of the latter rain. And so here's a message that was preparing that, message of righteousness by faith, a message that would prepare people for the Holy Spirit to be poured out. And in fact, elsewhere she even says that it was the beginning of the outpouring of the latter rain. Page 1122.3, she says they were giving the message for this time. And then page 1336.2, she describes this message in these words, in this letter to Elder Olson, the GC president, a most precious message. The message that God commanded to be given to the world. She says it is the third angel's message, which is to be proclaimed with a loud voice and attended with the outpouring of his spirit in a large measure. And then lastly, 1814, page 1814.4, she says it was a message to the world to prepare a people to stand in the day of God. We don't understand as we ought, in a practical sense, what will enable people to stand in the very difficult times ahead. And she saw this message, the message of righteous by faith, a message of total dependence on a power outside of yourself for salvation, and everything that flows out of that dependence, the victory and the effectiveness of ministry. She saw that as that which would prepare people to stand, and to enable others to stand as well. In other words, carrying the message to the world. 2 years later, 1893, he was 43 years of age at this time, and Ellen White had been in Australia some 2 years also, going on 2 years. Ellen White sent him a letter counseling him to avoid extreme views on faith and works. This is in the 1888 materials, page 1165, and thereabouts. And just an extract of what she was addressing that will give a feel for that. Often when we're presenting the subject of any Bible doctrine, we have to have a clear balance in terms of that. There's often two extremes, two ditches that we need to avoid. And in ourselves as human beings, we do not have inherent balance. We always are pulled one direction or the other, away from the central emphasis that needs to be made. And God through His Spirit needs to help us to avoid the extreme positions. And one way He does that is by putting us together with other people. Back in Jones's time, one way obviously he did that was sending special messages from the messenger. This is what Ellen White described and said to him. In my dream, you were presenting the subject of faith and the imputed righteousness of Christ by faith. You repeated several times that works amounted to nothing, that there were no conditions. She says, there are conditions. And then she said further, I know your meaning, but you leave a wrong impression upon many minds. If we look at the history of what Jones was saying and writing, it seems clear that she was warning him from a position that he was about to take, because there's no clear documentation that he ever said that there were no conditions. So sometimes God gives us a warning of where we're headed before we even get there. So that's clearly a counsel that he received from her. The next year, 1894, he's 44 years old, and he supports Anna Rice, a young lady who, in the United States, after Ellen White went to Australia, began to say that she had messages from God. She was a new messenger. And so some of the leaders actually were convinced that she was a genuine messenger, until Ellen White rebuked them. And in Ellen White's rebuke to these young men, Jones was one of them, Prescott was another one, they received her rebuke and actually immediately publicly confessed that they had been in error in supporting this young lady as a messenger. Ellen White, interestingly enough, in writing to some of the older leaders, specifically in a letter to S.N. Haskell, Ellen White described how that some of the older workers, maybe not Haskell so much, but some of the other ones that were not supportive of Jones's position, they were standing back rather than getting close to these younger men. They were standing back, waiting for them to make a mistake so that they could discredit them. And she said to the regarding these older workers, you have been around, you have seen people claiming to be messengers in the past. You are more cautious than these young men who are full of zeal. You should have been close to the young men. You should have been working with them. You should have been counseling them rather than standing back waiting for them to make a mistake. The responsibility for their stumbling over this issue lies with the older workers, not with the younger ones. And then she says, I have more confidence in these young men after this mistake than I did before because of their willingness to take a reproof. The dynamic was basically this. She said, they are so eager to follow God, to follow whatever light he has to send them, that it makes sense that they would make a mistake, misstep, in supporting someone who appeared at first to be from God and then later would prove not to be. Interestingly enough, Anna Rice herself took Ellen White's counsel that her messages were not from God, and she gave up any such claims and remained as a faithful Bible worker for the church. There was divine wisdom in how that case was handled, but unfortunately, through the years, many people have used this incident erroneously to discredit Jones as well as Prescott, whereas Ellen White allows for no such position, stating that she had more confidence in them afterwards than before. 1897, some 3 years later, Jones is 47 years of age. He's elected member of the General Conference Committee, and he remains a member of that General Conference Committee until 1901. Same year, 1897, he's appointed editor of the Review and Herald, a position he also holds through 1901. We find a report of those appointments in the Review and Herald, October 5, 1897, on page 640. The next year, he's 48 years of age, 1898, and he publishes The Great Empires of Prophecy, From Babylon to the Fall of Rome. This is the second of the prophetic books that he's written on these overviews of history, but actually is the also volume two in terms of the sequence that we'll be looking at of all of these books put together. The first one, we recall, was The Two Republics, Rome and the United States. So that was included the last of the Empires of Prophecy and then extended clear down into the United States, current time. 3 years later, at the 1901, he's 51 years of age, and this was the year we said that he remained a General Conference Committee member until, and then also editor of the Review until 1901. 1901, he becomes president of the California Conference, and he remains that through 1904. And that year, he publishes two more books, one called Ecclesiastical Empire, again, the picture of the union of church and state, extending from the past to the present, as well as the book The Great Nations of Today. These are nations that existed in the 1800s, in the turn of the century there into the early 1900s, and he's touching on their place in prophecy as well as some of the significant events of those times. Those two volumes then dealt with the latter portions of his overview of history. 1902, he's 52, he declines to chair the General Conference Committee. It should be noted here that from 1901 to 1903, there was no such position as president of the General Conference. They changed the Constitution of the Church in 1901 and did away with the presidency in an attempt to lessen the kingly power that had been developing. So there was only a committee elected to run the church, and that committee elected its chair, which basically the chair of the committee was the chief executive position in the church, equivalent in essence to presidency. And he declined a request to chair that committee in 1902. Same year, Ellen White, May 7, writes him a letter another letter of reproof. We might note here that often God sends messages of reproof through messengers because he's telling people their needs. He's usually not telling people what they're doing right. He's giving them more counsel as to where the problems might be. And just some brief excerpts from this letter would indicate to us some of the struggles that Jones was dealing with, common to human nature in general, but very specifically addressed to him. She says, "Elder Jones, I am much pained by your incautious statements. You speak rashly. You are not sanctified by the truth you handle. Your spirit needs to be refined. You are too self-confident, too sure that everything you say possesses a power which will obtain assent to it from those who hear." It's found in Volume 11 of Manuscript Releases, page 209.3. So the truth that Jones had been given by God, that she describes earlier, these flood of light, precious light of truth, she said he needed this very truth himself to be sanctified by it. And that would refine his spirit, cause him to be more cautious in his statements, to not speak so rashly, to not be self-confident, and not be so sure about his statements possessing a power that would convict everybody. So again, the need of humility and dependence upon God, which the message of righteousness by faith definitely does teach. And then she added this in the same letter, page 210.1. "God does not want the ways and words of A.T. Jones to be woven into your discourses." We might remember the statement of Jesus, where he says, "The words that I speak are not my words. I do not speak of myself." She was encouraging Jones to do the same thing. The ways and words of A.T. Jones should not be in your discourses. 1903, he's 53 years of age now, and he becomes involved with the difficulties and the tensions that occur between John Harvey Kellogg and the medical work and the administration of the church, including Ellen White. You'll recall that 1903 is the year after the sanitarium burns to the ground and the publishing house burns to the ground. And in April of 1903, Ellen White gives him a letter to take to John Harvey Kellogg. He was to read those to Dr. Kellogg, but Ellen White had a double motive in this. She wanted Jones to hear the counsel as well. And unfortunately, it appears both of these men now were moving in a direction to not receive counsel. And against Ellen White's advice, Jones actually moves to Battle Creek at Kellogg's invitation to teach at Kellogg's school, the American Medical Missionary College, where our early physicians were trained in conjunction with some clinical work at Ann Arbor, Michigan, the University of Michigan. In August of that year, he's asked to be head of the college. He publishes that same year The Place of the Bible in Education, based on his understanding of the application of the gospel message to educational work. He publishes this important book on the place of Bible. He wrote also a 21-page tract that same year, 1903, entitled One Man Power. Again, the danger of putting too much executive power, authority in one person. Obviously, Romanism does this to a significant extent, and he had seen trends of that in the church. Ellen White in the 1890s having written letters about the kingly power that our church was struggling with as well. That's what led them to remove the position of presidency from the General Conference for the 2 years, 1901 to 1903. The next year, 1904, age of 54, Jones was president of the Seventh-day Adventist Educational Society. Significant that it's the year after he publishes the book on the place of the Bible in education. However, that same year, we find him at Berrien Springs defending John Harvey Kellogg at the significant meeting they had in May, in which the issues of Kellogg's teachings on pantheism was addressed. And Prescott showed strongly that Kellogg was in the wrong direction. Jones, contrarily, came to Kellogg's defense and tried to show that Ellen White had been writing the same things and that Prescott had been writing the same things as well. That same year, Jones publishes this significant book of prophecy, The Empires of the Bible, From the Confusion of Tongues to the Babylonian Captivity. With this volume, the last of these history books, he actually publishes the first of the whole series, if we want to put them into a series, because this begins with the confusion of tongues, these empires that are spoken of in Genesis that we think of and hear of very little these days. So this would be volume one in the series, Empires of the Bible, From the Confusion of Tongues to the Babylonian Captivity. Volume two was the volume published in 1898, The Great Empires of Prophecy, From the Fall of Babylon, from Babylon to the Fall of Rome. The third volume would have been Ecclesiastical Empires, looking at the union of church and state in the experience of religious Rome. The fourth one was the one published in 1891, 10 years earlier. The Ecclesiastical Empires was 1901. 1891 was the two republics, or Rome and the United States, tying from Rome to the United States. And then the last volume would have been The Great Nations of Today, published in 1901. 1905, the next year after 1904, at the age of 55, he goes to Washington, D.C. for meetings on religious liberty at Ellen White's recommendation and counsel, but he does not stay long, and we soon find him back in Battle Creek with the work there with Dr. Kellogg in the rebuilding of the hospital and the work that flowed out of that. That year, in 1905, at the General Conference session, his credentials were renewed. However, the next year, 1906, at the age of 56, in March, he actually publicly, at the sanitarium there in Battle Creek, gives a talk on the differences that he has with the church, the conflict that he has with the church, the points that he has of conflict with the church. And it's that year, 1906, that Ellen White plainly states that he has lost his way. He's apostatized. And June of that year, this is what she wrote. I have been permitted to view the case of Elder A.T. Jones. His bitterness is as gall, though he has been warned. At Washington during the General Conference, I conversed with him for about 3 hours, but he would not receive my warnings. He seemed very self-confident. And when he spoke of his work at Battle Creek, his boastings were a surprise to many. All that I could say to him at Washington seemed to make no impression upon his mind. It's in the Paulson Collection, page 125.1. So it's clear that at this point he began to lose his hold on the anchor, which was God's guidance through the messenger, began to ally himself with Dr. Kellogg, who was definitely on his way out of the church and trying to pull as much of the medical work away from the church as possible. The next year, at the age of 57, May of 1907, he is asked to turn in his ministerial credentials. The following year, at the age of 58, he was disfellowshipped from the Berkeley, California Seventh-day Adventist Church. The next year, 1909, age of 59, I believe this was at the 1909 General Conference session, there was actually a public hearing conducted to review his case at his own request, but he was not reconciled to the church, and there was no confidence placed back in him. Some 3 years later, 1912, he's 62 years of age, and he joins the Kalamazoo, Michigan, Seventh-day Adventist Reform Movement, who gave him their own credentials. But 2 years later, 1914, he's 64, they disfellowshipped him from the Reform Movement. The next year, in 1915, he's 65 years of age, he goes to Washington, D.C., and he joins the People's Church, which was a group of Seventh-day Adventists who were actually also removing themselves from conference association. At that same time in Washington, D.C., he founded and published what he called the American Sentinel of Religious Liberty, and he published that from that year, 1915, through 1923, some 8 or 9 years there. In 1921, at the age of 71, he returns to Battle Creek, and a couple of years later, in May of that year, he suffers a stroke at the age of 73, and he dies shortly after the stroke on May the 12th, 1923. So that's the overview of the life of A.T. Jones, a man who God used in an amazing way, a man who God led to study extensively the history. And then when he put the history together with the third angel's message, the prophecy, saw the very powerful significance of religious liberty and the involvement of the message of righteous by faith at the core of the final messages to the world, presented that with power in many different venues, endorsed repeatedly, extensively by the messenger of the Lord, working alongside of him, encouraging, guiding him, reproving him, writing extensively, books that still bless us, but then toward the end, stumbling and not continuing to be sanctified by the light that God had given him to share with others, and succumbing to following his own will, his own thoughts, thinking his way was better than what God was telling him, and becoming very independent, taking the theme of religious liberty to the extreme, where liberty means I am free to not listen to anyone, but only to God directly. And God doesn't do that. He does speak with us directly, but he also speaks through the body. And he leads us in a path that, as we're told, presses together, does not fly apart into individuality in religion, which one of his documents is called. God does deal with us individually, but we must always remember that he deals with us corporately as well. So let's be blessed by the light God poured through Jones. Let's learn from his mistakes. Let's repent of any tendency we have to go that direction. Let's humbly ask the Lord to guide us in a way that we not repeat these mistakes. Otherwise, God's people just continue making the same mistakes over and over again and prolonging the mission of the church and delaying the return of Christ. So let's learn from that, the experience of A.T. Jones.